Alex, and thank you, London Insight, for putting this event on, and also for Conscious 2 for making it available to all of you who are watching it on your computers, no doubt all over the world. Let me just say a little bit about how we would like to organise this evening. We're going to start with the three of us offering reflections upon the theme, early Buddhism, theory and practice, after which we'll open the topic to the floor and field whatever questions or comments that you would like to share with us. And that'll take us probably that'll take about an hour and a half or so. So early Buddhism theory and practice is very much a passion, I think I can fairly say, for the three of us. Early Buddhism not being the same as any particular Buddhist orthodoxy, it's not equivalent to Theravada Buddhism, but it has to do with the earliest source materials that we have available on what the historical Buddha taught in the 5th century BCE. And I'd like to start by inviting John to offer his reflections upon this topic. John Peacock.
Okay. Well, welcome everybody. Some reflections on early Buddhism. Well, early Buddhism is a massive topic. Let's just say that right from the beginning. In fact, Buddhism is a massive topic, as most of you will probably be aware of. All too often, we associate Buddhism with being all of these various traditions that we have. In fact, in the West, I often say that we have a shop window on virtually every tradition of Buddhism that we see around the world. However, when we approach traditions, we get traditional responses. We get a history which is usually tied to the propagation of some particular tradition and some particular lineage or dynasty or way of understanding. And when we start to talk about early Buddhism, really what we're trying to do is inquire as much as we can within, really within the tools that we have available to us. We're starting to inquire into something at a much, in a sense, much earlier period, hence the reason early Buddhism. It's a strangely elastic phrase, early Buddhism, that it stretches quite a long way, and particularly for scholars. But I think Stephen Akinchino and myself have a fairly good understanding of what we mean by early Buddhism, and I think Stephen has alluded to it already by referring to this strata of textuality which exists in a number of ways. We have it in Pali tradition, this language, Indian language, which is some of the earliest recorded material we have. It isn't the earliest. We have recorded material in other languages as well, and we also have Chinese translations of early Sanskrit material, which has also been lost. So we have this early material which we're delving into and finding as we delve into it. And the title of this evening, as you're well aware, is Theory and Praxis, or Theory and Practice. But when we start to delve into it from a theoretical perspective, we see sometimes a very different vision of what Buddhism is about in its early inception. It's interesting, for example, to note in its very earliest phase, in some of the earliest texts we have available, I think most scholars are fairly agreed that there's a particular text called the Sutta Nipata, which is a very, very old text, certain portions of it, preserved in Pali, which is this Middle Indian, Middle Indo-Aryan language, which I've already referred to. We have material which is preserved within that, which gives a picture of Buddhism which is unsystematized. If you've been on the fringes or been involved with Buddhism at all, you will know that Buddhists are list fetishists. They love lists, and lists within lists. You know, we get these huge quantities of lists, and this goes right back actually to a fairly early phase. But when we start to look at some of this early unsystematized material, we don't find lists. We get a very, very different picture of even what the monastic order was about. The monastic order wasn't settled. It did not live in monasteries, and even the words sometimes that we use, like monastery and monks and nuns and all of these words which are oh so familiar, don't actually, when we start to look at the original languages, have any real purchase on the original Pali terms, on the original terms which are used in these Indic languages. So we get a very different picture. What we do get a picture of, and I think this is important when we start to talk about practice, I've talked very, very basically about the theoretical delvings into this early material, only one very small aspect of it. But when we start looking at it from a practice eye viewpoint, then we also look at somebody who was totally engaged with their society. Early Indian society and the way that the Buddha engages with it, and or I should say his engagement with it, is total. Even down to stealing bits of language and reversing them, turning them against their normal meanings, borrowing language from the Brahmins, borrowing language from the Jains, borrowing language from wherever he gets it. In fact, we can say generally that the Buddha does not invent any term that he uses. He generally borrows it from the traditions which are extant in his own time, and then uses them for particular purposes, sometimes polemical, to make points and to score points off the particular traditions that are there, but particularly to redirect us back to our own processes and understanding what those processes are. And in many ways, and this is a claim I've often made over the years of my teaching, is that the Buddha in many ways is a proto-psychologist. He's certainly the first person in ancient India, if not the world, I would claim, to start using some form of psychological language to begin to help to unravel what it means to be a human being, and perhaps to be a human being that flourishes in this world rather than suffers. This is the remit of his teaching, and he makes this very, very clear whether we look at a theoretical basis or on this entirely practical basis. So I think when we start to look at early Buddhism, it's not just so much from looking at it from an interesting theoretical perspective. It is very interesting. I would actually say, well, we are all passionate about this, and we're passionate about it because not only does it give us a window into these very early traditions, and sometimes completely at odds with the way that the traditions themselves have grown up culturally. As you will well know, that Buddhism has migrated to different cultures, and as it's migrated, it's often taken on so much of that culture. We're no different in the West. This is actually what is happening in the Western world at the moment. Our engagement with what we call this tradition of Buddhism is very much a Western engagement. By delving back into the early material, by seeing this radically different perspective sometimes on what is there, some of the familiar teachings don't seem so familiar. Teachings on karma, I deliberately use the Sanskrit term, teachings on karma do not look the way they do often within the traditions. Teachings on rebirth, teachings on dependent origination, one of the Buddha's principal teachings, none of these, actually, when we start to delve into them in this sort of way that I've been outlining, begin to look the same at all. And in fact, I would suggest, actually, when we do start to look at these things, they can have a radical impact on the way that we practice in the West. So just to take a very quick example before, I don't know how much time I have left.
You have 5 minutes.
Okay. When we start to look at this from these radical perspectives and start to get a key into the Buddha's perspective, let's start off with one of the things I've mentioned so far. The Buddha's radical engagement with his society. Well, as Buddhist practitioners in the West, we need to be radically engaged with our society. We need to be radically engaged with the tropes of our society, the primary tropes, and we see that very much with the engagement, perhaps, with philosophy, with psychology, with scientific disciplines. All of these are being brought to bear, particularly with the secularization of mindfulness in the Western world. All of these are being brought to bear on this ancient tradition. So that's the first stage, really, this radical engagement. When we start to look at the early material and start to get these different perspectives from the texts by looking at them, and suddenly becoming aware, actually, that the stories that we've had, often posited by the traditions, are just that, they are stories. They're stories and ways of trying to comprehend what the Buddha has said, and they're based on very selective readings of some of this early material, which is actually a shared heritage. And perhaps some of the others might say some more about this, but this is a shared heritage. So the early Pali material, for example, is mirrored in these Chinese translations from Sanskrit material. We have fragments of other material which also appears to be of this absolutely early shared common heritage. Now, when we look into this material in any depth and start to reread it, and particularly close readings of this with a practitioner's viewpoint, not necessarily a scholar's viewpoint, although the two are not absolutely mutually exclusive, when we start to do this, it can actually begin to radicalize A, our understanding of what's going on in Buddhism, and B, radically affect the way that we practice. The two, again, go hand in hand. They're actually interwoven. And I think this is extremely important if we're thinking seriously and not just buying into what I call the party line of traditions. If we're not buying into that party line of traditions, let's take something that the Buddha is always quoted as saying, one should question, one should analyse, one should approach, and not take it merely on hearsay or the fact that he has said it. Usually the traditions pay lip service to this. And perhaps I'm being slightly contentious here, but the traditions often pay lip service to this and don't actually do what the Buddha says. When we start to look at the early material, we begin to get this different perspective, and perhaps it will make us begin to engage with this material in a very different way, which will affect the ways that we practice and affect even what we call meditation. And we can see it in a much, much wider perspective. One of the other aspects, and perhaps I'm seeing Stephen stare at me slightly over my shoulder, so I'm going to wind up. Because I could go on, as the other two well know. One of the other aspects I think is extremely important about this is we begin to get a good understanding of the way the languages work. Because the languages themselves, when we begin to, again, not necessarily approach it from a particularly scholastic perspective, but just having a good understanding, a sort of acquaintance with these languages, again, we start to give different perspectives, because actually the lexicon of words that we have inherited from the traditions, and that includes the Western tradition of translation, is actually very poor for conveying what is meant, particularly in these early Buddhist understandings. Stephen.
Thank you very much, John. Let's now just move on to Akinchana. Could you maybe now offer your reflections on early Buddhism, its theory and its practice? Thank you.
So I think John has sketched out basically an inspiration I believe we share. What that actually translates into is work. Yeah. The truth is we have a lot of work ahead. Much of the richness of these of this early Buddhist tradition currently in the hands of the famous and the hallowed Buddhist lineages needs another looking at. And this looking at needs to take place in our societies. It needs, as John said, with a form of engagement that has both an eye on the authenticity of a message that is old and strangely modern. At the same time, we need to look with the other eye to where we are, what we need, what is actually happening here, and how these teachings relate to our time. So generally that needs several translations. One of them is obviously from a source language into a target language, and then we end up usually with something one of the scholars slightly amused called Buddhist hybrid English, which means it's basically a kind of English and you recognize some words, but you're still not quite sure what it means. Because it's kind of translated technical terms, which translators try hard to do justice to their source text, but somehow it doesn't quite reflect the sort of language we use to speak about ourselves, let alone to think about ourselves. Now, one of the ways we do think about ourselves in at least the last, I would say, just about 100 years is we think about ourselves in psychological terms. Even though you may think you have nothing to do with the netherworlds of psychology, you're very likely to reflect on yourself and your inner personal experience in psychological terms. This is just something that seems to have happened within the last 100 years. It wasn't the case only 50 years ago, but nowadays it is the case. Most people, when they talk about their inner experience, they use psychological language, psychological concepts, psychological imagery, even if they haven't studied psychology. They use it more freely if they haven't studied psychology. So one of the ways I think early Buddhism ought to be engaged with from our point of view is that we do that second part of translation. We have fabulous translators who do engage on a primary philological level with these materials. And let me say here, Buddhism hasn't really arrived in the West. We have, I believe, started with the teaspoon. We have a few scrapings with the teaspoon of the richness of this contemplative tradition. We have a couple of books. We have a burgeoning secondary literature, but there is still in the quarry of early Buddhism many, many precious things are to be found which we haven't started really engaging with in a deep way. We've been fascinated with some aspects of meditation, we've been fascinated with some aspects of philosophy, some of us have engaged with ethics, but there's a lot more Buddhism out there that has actually arrived in our societies. Even the Buddhist world is rather cavalier in its engagement with the richness and the depth of these Buddhist teachings. There's so much more out there than has really arrived in the midst of our Buddhist Western world. That is my opinion. And I hope that our institute is going to help a little bit bringing some more of that richness across. That will mean engaging with it from different vantage points. One such vantage point, obviously, is psychological models. As you know, Western psychology is a fascinating field, but it's slightly confusing in its variety of approaches. We're still lacking a unified field theory for happiness. We're not really clear about what exactly a self model is. In fact, we have so many self models that it's slightly troublesome to even engage trying to correlate Buddhist notions of self with Western psychological models of self, because my choice for Western models of self is such that I, can take without great effort at least half a dozen post-classical analytic models and choose anyone to try to square it with Buddhism, which obviously doesn't do Buddhism much justice. Yeah? So that discourse needs deepening, and it needs deepening on two levels. One, we need to understand more of what is there of early Buddhism. And I repeat, there is much research going on in these days. The story of early Buddhism, as we thought it was written 30, 40 years ago, turns out to be actually rather different. 30, 40 years ago, we believed that the Buddha was living 100 years earlier than it turns out that he lives. We thought that the Buddha was speaking Pali. He doesn't. We thought that Pali texts are the oldest. Looks like we have actually older texts than Pali texts. You know, many of the things we believed were true 40 years ago actually turn out more and more not to be really as we thought they were. One of the reasons that is the case is because people are doing research and they're finding fascinating stuff. And that stuff usually is held in the hands of a few scholars, and it takes a few years till that percolates through into the Buddhist world. Now, Buddhists are not really famous for reading Buddhist research. In fact, the stereotyped Buddhist response to Buddhist scholasticism is mistrust at best. Sometimes Buddhist practitioners seem to think that the natural enemy of the Buddhist practitioner is the Buddhologist, because this is the person who studies my stuff without believing it. We are of the impression that we're interested in speaking to practitioners. At the same time, I think we all subscribe to the faith that both the practitioner and the scholar are not mutually exclusive. In fact, they need each other bitterly. I don't have to account for the scholars, I have to account for the practitioner, to which I account myself, and it would help many a Buddhist practitioner to know a little bit something about Buddhist history. You can have all kinds of funny ideas about authenticity and the validity of your pet beliefs, probably handed down to you by one of the lineages, without actually this standing the test of genuine scholarship. So early Buddhist teachings are a vibrant and live pool of materials which we hope to make ourselves more familiar with, and which we hope to help translate, largely translate into a dialogue. My four speakers have spoken, but this dialogue nowadays is a secular dialogue. Whatever you want to make of that term secular, the crucial issues in our time are dealt with in secular terms. And if Buddhism wants to have something to say in this, if something of what comes from that early Buddhist tradition is to have any value in our time, then this Buddhism needs to engage with our time on secular terms. That's a dialogue of natural sciences, it's the dialogue in psychology, it's the dialogue in economics, it's the dialogue of political philosophy. Any of these dialogues basically take place in a language that is secular. And if Buddhism and the values Buddhism conveys are to have any bearing on these fields, then Buddhists need to come out of their ivory towers and start talking about the stuff they care. So, early Buddhist teaching, I believe, is tremendous promise, tremendous richness beyond of what has arrived in our cherished anthologies and cherished Buddhist best-of list. And that kind of work we hope to engage with in the coming time. Maybe I'll just stop here for a moment and see.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm going to say a few words, but then we'll actually come, the three of us together, and we'll maybe just comment on each other's presentations. I'm going to continue, of course, much in the same vein, but would like to just highlight some rather different points. This afternoon, I went to see the exhibition of Ai Weiwei, the Chinese artist at the Royal Academy. And it's a marvelous exhibition. And the reason that I think it has some relevance here is because a number of his works were made out of the ruined beams of wood and bricks of destroyed Buddhist temples from the Ming period and Qing periods, which he then rebuilt as works of art. And I think very much in terms of our work with early Buddhism, as in some senses doing a similar thing. We're taking these old materials that we find, not only, as my friends have been saying, in specific texts, but here, there, and everywhere in Buddhist cultures, and we are recovering some of these materials and then putting them together in ways that imaginatively construe them in forms and in discourses and in practices that speak to the condition of our time today, just as Ai Weiwei's sculptures of these remains of these early temples are now transformed into what I feel are very moving and very potent works of art that speak to our time today. One of the reasons, therefore, that I find early Buddhism to be so engaging is because it takes us back to a period before Buddhism became another organized Indian religion. As Buddhism, or the teachings of the Dharma, which frankly I find a more helpful phrase than this ism word, The early teachings of the Dharma mutated through the Buddhist community's interactions with the other religions and cultures of ancient India and gave rise to Buddhism as an Indian religion, holding many of the same soteriological goals, many of the same beliefs that are common to the Hindus and to the Jains and others. So when we use this term early Buddhism, we're in a sense putting into brackets, we're suspending the idea of Buddhism as an Indian religion. And we're trying to get back to something that predates those forms and brings us into contact with, as John particularly was saying, into another understanding of the Buddha's teaching that sometimes even contradicts doctrines that we take to be well-established Buddhist teachings. So when we go back to the early sources, I find that often we encounter something that is far more radical in its import than what is often being crystallized into the formal orthodoxies of what we know as Buddhism. And this allows us, I feel, the opportunity to, in a way, rethink the Dharma from the ground up. That instead of trying to adapt Theravada Buddhism or Zen Buddhism or Tibetan Buddhism into a form that's somehow more palatable, perhaps, with our modern worldview, we actually go back to these core ideas, core practices, and find another foundation in which to rethink the Dharma for our times, very much as Kinchino also was expressing. And I think this whole process, this whole way of thinking, just as we tend to be psychological in our thinking, even if we don't know the theories of Freud terribly well, another feature of our Western culture, our modern culture, is what we call historical consciousness. And this is something that traditional Buddhist societies didn't really have in a very strongly developed way. As Western people, trained as we are to understand the historical origins of cultures and of different societies and so on, we can also see that Buddhism is never a fixed thing, but it is a dependently arisen phenomenon that has emerged out of its interactions with Indian and then Chinese and Tibetan and Korean and Japanese societies, such that those particular forms emerged. What we bring to that process in the West, and I don't even like the word the West now, we're really talking of an emerging global consciousness of understanding things, is the very quality of historical consciousness itself. That we cannot but see Buddhism as an evolving process that keeps reinventing itself each time it finds itself in a new situation, a new historical period, a different cultural situation. So what we're doing here is no different to what has gone on in the past, when Buddhism went to China, for example, or to Tibet. It was changed, it was modified. But the difference is that as Westerners, we see that very clearly. It seems almost obvious to us. And as soon as we use the word obvious, it means that we're referring to something we have internalized, a view of the world that has become almost a second nature. And this, I think, has a number of consequences. One consequence is that the Buddha himself, the figure of Gautama, becomes an historical figure. The Buddha, as represented in many of traditional Buddhist schools, has become a kind of deified, perfect being, more like a god than a person in many ways. When we get back to these early texts, we don't just find these radically different ideas, we also encounter Gautama as a human person living in a particular historical epoch about which we now know a great deal more, as Kinchino mentioned. Our knowledge of India at that period continues to grow. And the more that we can locate this person in that world, and again, the Pali materials are rich not just because of the ideas that they convey, but also because they give us a very vivid glimpse into the political, economical, social world in which this figure of Gautama operated. That too challenges many assumptions we have as to what constitutes the life and the person of the Buddha, the awakened one. I think also it challenges our idea of the very notion of what we consider to be practice. Practice is often in traditional Buddhist schools almost synonymous with the idea of being somehow expert in certain spiritual or meditative disciplines. And when we say, I'm going to do my practice, very often that means I'm going to sit in a room on a cushion, light a stick of incense, and do an exercise for 20 or 30 minutes. That's my practice. When we go back to the early sources, we find the Buddha speaks of practice in a far more comprehensive way. Practice, or bhavana, is something that applies to every aspect of the Eightfold Path. Every aspect, in other words, of what it means to be human. From the way we see the world, the way we forge intentions to act, the way we speak, the way we work, and of course the way we pay attention, the way we meditate, the way we concentrate. All of these features of the path are to be realized, practiced, brought into being. So we move away from the world of monastics living in monasteries who developed probably very deep philosophies. They became very expert in certain spiritual exercises and techniques, and we recover a sense of practice that has to do with our flourishing as human persons in the world in which we are embedded now. So my own take on the early Buddhist tradition is that it returns us to something that is more comprehensive in its notions of practice. It restores a deep sense of humanity to the person we know as the Buddha, and it allows us access to certain core ideas and principles that are quite distinctive from what we would find in Hinduism and Jainism and other Indian traditions, that allow us to re-envision what this Dharma is able to offer us, both personally and, of course, socially, communally, possibly even in terms of our relationship to our economy, our political life. And I feel that after all of my years involved in different Buddhist traditions and practices, that we touch here in these early teachings something that is radical, something that is potentially transformative, not just in our own personal life, but also in the kind of world we live in together with others at this time in history. So maybe you've got a picture, three different pictures, covering very much the same territory, but maybe articulating them in slightly different ways. And I wonder whether John or Akinchino would like to add to what they've already said something that's come from the contributions of Akinchino and well, the three of us. John?
Thanks. I just want to pick up on something that Stephen was saying there finally, which was about the picture we get of the Buddha. I think as a flesh and blood person, I think this is very, very important. I mean, particularly given that he's introducing us to our existential dilemmas, generally translated as suffering. But it's quite good to know, in a way, that this person who is teaching us this actually had similar dilemmas, went through those things, and isn't just some kind of transcendent cipher, which is actually the way often the Buddha gets represented. I think the other thing that really I think was important coming out from what Stephen was saying at the end here is his radicalization. I think it's radical for a start off to see the Buddha as a living flesh human being who had situations of ambiguity he had to deal with, suffered backache, interestingly enough, when you read the early texts. Complains that he's like an old cart who's only kept going by being strapped up every morning. You know, these are very, very human situations, but his radicalization is the radical nature of his teaching. And I think seeing him as a human being helps us to understand this radical nature of the teaching. And I think what we get when we start to look at early Buddhism is a much, much more nuanced understanding. Something which is perhaps, I think, again, both, I think all of us have alluded to it in some way, is something which is very, very modern, but very, very ancient as well. And it's bringing that in a sense of trying to go back and actually recapture something that has been lost in traditionalization. In the formation of the traditions, we lose something. We get a coherent story. I'm not saying these are not coherent, but we also lose a lot. We lose a lot in losing that historical Buddha. We lose a lot in the radicalization of that teachings. In fact, I would suggest slightly polemically, but sometimes what the history of the Buddhist traditions have done is try to tame that radicalization.
What I believe one of the most crucial modernist facets of early Buddhist teaching I see in a tremendous empowerment to turn with whatever intelligence we have at work and use that intelligence with obviously a training in forms of intention and attention and meditative skill, and apply these skills on the workings of our own mind, the workings of our own, look at the process of our own experience. And this as the transformative key practice which is liberating the human heart. That is absolutely unparalleled. I still believe this is one of the most inspiring messages coming from more than 2.5 millennia ago to us, that if we turn the qualities of mind with some training and with some, as Stephen has said, bhavana, which extends both to this body and its relationship to the whole physical world, the relationship towards our own experience and to the social world as the second dimension of bhavana, plus specific trainings in the stilling of mind and learning to deepen the empathetic nature of the human mind, plus specific skills which have to do with the development of wisdom. If such a training is undertaken and then applied to the mechanics of one's own experience, that this is the transformative key liberating us from suffering. That is a tremendously powerful message for me to today. And I see that in great radicality suggested right there in those early texts, right there in that first layer of Buddhist transmission we have. Before that is the transmission of a particular lineage, but actually it's a voice that speaks to us in quite different voices, because one of the beauty of these early teachings is they come to us in quite a pluralistic fashion. They are accounts of situational, they're records of situational scenarios. And if we take upon ourselves the effort, make the effort to travel through them, we actually find a world we are very, very familiar with from our days. It's a pluralistic world. It's a world with fears that we recognize. It's a world with promises that we recognize. And it has a vision of happiness and the vision of completeness that is still inspiring to me. So turning the mind's gifts, the mind's capacities to its own functioning as the transformative key that is liberative for the human heart. That is a powerful message. I can actually find nothing that inspires me as much as that, to be honest with you.
Thank you. Okay. We're actually very much on time, which is great. And it's now, I think, the moment to turn the microphones to you. Can we open, is it hot? Too hot in here? Should we open some windows? If you're by a window, maybe we could just get some fresh air. Thank you. Just to remember what Alex was saying, that if you ask a question, you're going to have a camera possibly looking at you. If you don't want to be on in the public view, then I'm afraid you should not ask a question. That's the only way we can do this, I'm afraid. The microphones will be passed around. We're going to repeat the question because the internet audience won't hear the roving mic on their headphones or computers. You can direct a question at any one of us or simply to the three of us, and we'll take it in turns, or we'll simply respond how it seems best. So we start here.
I actually forgot to say if you could stand up when you ask a question, that would be helpful.
Why?
It's so that people can see you.
No, people just need to hear me. I don't want to stand up. Is that all right?
Okay, fine. Let's go.
Okay, so I've got a few questions. You mentioned the karma, which you referred to differently, and I'm interested in finding out what the difference is in the way it's been interpreted. And you mentioned psychological terms, of how we refer to the self, but you didn't give any practical examples. So if you could give one, that would really appreciate it. And then what language did the Buddha speak, if he didn't speak Pali? And...
Wait. Can we just do it?
Okay.
This is a shopping list.
We've got one each. The questions, should I just summarize them?
Please.
They have to do with what John was meaning about karma. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? And how that was, in a sense, different in early Buddhism. Models of self was mentioned by Akinchana. And could we please have a practical example? And thirdly, what language did the Buddha speak if he didn't speak Pali?
John. One more. Where can you access information about early Buddhism?
We will come to that at the end, don't worry. Okay.
Okay, I think it's me first, isn't it?
Succinct questions for you.
Very good, thank you.
Karma. This is a word that's known. It's entered into the English language, hasn't it? In many ways. I mean, people use it. I mean, even John Lennon wrote a song about it. So we get a picture of karma. Even an English football manager got into trouble about talking about karma at one time. If you can cast your minds back.
Hoddle.
Glenn Hoddle, that's it. Yeah, it's Glenn Hoddle. Okay, so this is really important because we understand this. The traditions paint a particular picture of karma, which is basically that everything that happens to us is a result of karma. It's a result of previous actions, which often, sometimes in the traditions, associated with a previous life, particularly. And we're laying down actions now, which are going to have their fruition in another life. The model, which I won't go into about, is slightly wrong anyway, even just talking about it as karma. Karma is the action. The word simply means action in the original languages. And one of the things that the Buddha is saying, and I'll actually paraphrase the text, it's probably the easiest way, because I was perplexed about this, I think probably as we all were at some stage, is the Buddha really saying this? And everything that happens to you in your lifetime, whether you believe in lifetimes or not, everything that happens to you as a result of your actions. Because it clearly doesn't appear to be the case, does it? You know, stuff happens to people that you think, well, it's just unfair, just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And things of that sort. And in these early texts, in one particular text called the Sivaka Sutta, which is to be found in the connected discourses of the Buddha, there's a reference for you.
Vedana
Samyutta.
Yeah. Vedana
Samyutta.
Vedana Samyutta.
Get references as well. But in this sutta, basically somebody comes to the Buddha and says, are you saying the same as all the teachers who are around at the present, that everything that happens to you is the result of your actions, the result of your karma? And the Buddha goes, well, some things that happen to you are the result of phlegm. And some things that happen to you are a result of catarrh. And he goes on and he gives a list of these really basic things. And right at the end of this list, and actually, it's not so perplexing or as humorous sometimes when you actually look at this. These are the ancient Indian humours, which likely they would understand them in ancient Greek. But things happen to you because of the humours. And right at the end of this list, he said, and some of the things that happen to you are the result of your actions. So not everything in this particular picture that we get from early Buddhism is a result of your actions. Some, if we wanted to put it in terms of, you know, contemporary thought, would be as a result of your constitution. The way you know, genetically inherit something, for example, and develop a disease later in life. You know, this is not to do with your karma, it's to do with your constitution. And that was what the humours were trying to explain. And so we get a different picture from the picture that's often portrayed. I wouldn't say all the traditions, but pretty well quite a lot of them. That everything that happens to you is this pan-karmic idea. So that's really the difference we find.
So the next one, what did the Buddha speak?
We don't know. The model of self.
Good. Okay, you do that, Carl. Model of self. Self is a concept of rather late date. Most of the models of self in Western societies are products of the 20th century.
It is very specific.
Well, there are many models of self.
Give one example.
The Jungian model of self, for example, or the Kahutian model of self, or the Freudian model of self. These are starkly different models of self. Yeah? All of these models of self have been squared with Buddhist teachings on impersonality. Yeah? So there's two major branches of Buddhist teaching. One of them is called a teaching on anattā, often called the teaching on impersonality, or a teaching of non-self. And the self in the Buddhist teaching seems to be a rather different type of self than the self in Heinz Kohut's work, or in Sigmund Freud's work, or in Jung's work. Yeah. So one of the problems is we have a term that has all its connotations in the 20th century, or most of them. I know Shakespeare has said, you know, to thine own self be true kind of thing. So it's not that it's the 20th century that invented the word self, but it has given most of its connotations to this term. Now, if you take a term that got all its references from the 20th century and try to impute the Buddha meant that self, then you're obviously not going to make a statement about the Buddha, but you're going to make a statement about your misunderstandings. So that discourse obviously needs to be held by people who are both competent with self-models of the West and with what it might have meant to the Buddha. Good. That's as succinct as I can do.
Thank you. Well, so I'll address the third one, although arguably my colleagues are probably more competent in this field. Pali actually just means text. So Pali Vasya means the language of the texts. And this refers to the language that we find in the Pali canon as it was eventually, as it was remembered over centuries, then finally written down. But what we get, what we call Pali is actually somewhat of a hybrid, both of some probably Magadhi, the sort of language they spoke in the places where the Buddha lived, but over time it became inflected with other elements of Indian languages. In Western India, for example, it got certain elements of early Sanskrit, Brahmanic language also began to inflect it. So Pali is a kind of literary language that nobody actually spoke. The Buddha probably therefore spoke the Prakrits, in other words, the spoken languages that would have been prevalent in the particular areas of northeast India where he taught. These would have been of the same broad language group as what we now call Pali, but they are languages that would not be identical with Pali itself. Yes, this gentleman here with the glasses.
Hi, yes. So is there anything in the early texts that can equate to sort of, we have like a god in Christian traditions, or we have like the, you know, gods in the Hindu traditions? Is anything that you know, might be comparable to it's one part question. And talking about practice, you talked to say that the early ones might influence how we practice meditation today. You know, any sort of initial thoughts about those changes could be?
Okay, so the questions are there's two questions. The first one has to do with, is there anything in the early Buddhist text that has any equivalence to our concept of God? Either in our Judeo-Christian tradition or in the Indian traditions, or which are more like gods. And the second question has to do with the practice of what we may discover or find in the early texts that would affect our understanding of what it means to practice meditation, and if so, could we give a concrete example? Who would like to take that?
I can do the God bit.
You do the God bit. I can still do the God bit.
So, there is no equivalent of, say, a Judaic or a Christian God in Buddhist teaching. There is token reference to the pantheon of Vedic gods that the Buddhists have taken over and politely shelved in a side altar and subjected to impermanence, by the way, and said, yes, we're very respectful for them, but they're not really important for the liberative aspect of the teaching. So you have a couple of gods of Vedic origin turning up in Buddhist teachings, including some colorful ones, you know, a demon called Rahul. Rahul is appearing and responsible for eclipses of the sun, for example, as a monster that eats part of the sun or part of the moon, depending on which is having an eclipse. And there is total reference to this, but they have no soteriological significance. In other words, they're not of any importance when it comes to liberation. Some of them are protectors of the Dhamma. Sakal Brahman is quite an interesting character, has some connections with Indra, and is a person whose throne warms up if somebody makes superhuman efforts in his or her practice. So he's a kind of indicator for good practitioners to be around if his throne gets warmed.
Can I just add something as well?
Please.
I mean, it's quite interesting that there's gods with the small case abound in Buddhism. They're generally known as devas, and you'll find a whole section of this connected series of discourses, Sanghita Nikaya, devoted to conversations with gods, which is a bit like the Buddha trying to debunk the supernatural, because most of these gods turn out to be rather stupid. And the conversations generally take that turn, because the gods are coming to the Buddha to ask him for something. Now, the idea of a creator god, as Akinchino said, is totally bracketed out. It's of no interest whatsoever to the Buddha. It doesn't answer his questions, which are existential questions, basically.
So the question about meditation. Well, I think it's a good question. I think perhaps we should maybe just offer some reflections on something that's happening in our society now in a pretty big way. And that is how the practice of mindfulness is being incorporated into so many different fields of our contemporary life. And it's not as though mindfulness is some sort of marginal practice that occurs in a few obscure texts. Mindfulness lies at the very heart of Buddhist meditation practice. And I find it quite extraordinary, and also extraordinarily validate, in a way, of these early texts, that here we have a practice that the Buddha came to or developed in the 5th century BC. It's not a practice that you can find in any of the other Indian traditions. This is not borrowed from Hinduism or borrowed from Jainism. This is a form of meditation that is not concerned with turning inwards in order to discover the true nature of ourself, for example. Or it's not a form of meditation that seeks to achieve union with God, which would have been very much characteristic of the Brahminic meditations of that period. This is something that is profoundly distinctive and original in what the Buddha taught. And it's a meditation that is focused upon the phenomenal world. It's a meditation that attends to our actual moment-to-moment experience as flesh and blood creatures impacting with things that we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, other people, other forms of life. And it is, in that sense, something entirely revolutionary in the history of Indian thought. And I find it quite remarkable that when subjected to the kinds of clinical trials that are being done today on this practice, there is an increasing body of evidence that it's not just a unique thing that the Buddha came up with, but more importantly, it actually works. It actually has therapeutic benefits. And I'm sure a number of you are familiar with the cross-party parliamentary committee on mindfulness that issued its report last Friday in the Houses of Parliament, recommending certain policy changes or certain policy proposals to be taken up by government. Now, if someone had told me that this was going to happen 30 years ago when I was in India doing these meditations, I would have written them off as a fantasist, that you'd be able to get Buddhist meditation on the NHS. But the fact is, you can. So it's this kind of practice, I think, that provides us with the most concrete example of something that transcends the context of the Indian world, ancient Indian world, and seems to be as applicable as and effective in our lives today as it would have been then. A number of hands gone up there. Who's got the road in mind? Alex? You choose.
I'm interested in how you work out which are the early texts. Mm-hmm. How do you, because that seems to me very crucial, the criteria you use mm-hmm. to identify the early texts from the more traditional ones.
Okay.
I'd be really interested to hear something about that.
Great. Okay, so the question is, how do we work out, what criteria do we use to gain some confidence that a particular text is of an earlier rather than a later date? Is that correct? So how do we do this? How do we figure this out? John.
Well, one of the answers, or part of the answer, is on philological grounds. Basically, the way the language is used, the way the language is developed. And we can do this in Pali terms. Remember, in my little introduction, I refer to this very early text called the Sutta Nipata, of which parts of it are considered to be very ancient, probably originary, as much as we can say that. And bear in mind, some of this is hypothetical, so you have to kind of put it in scare quotes, but in terms of stratification of these texts and looking at what texts are old and what are more recent in this ancient history, then we're basically working on philological grounds. And the philological grounds are on the archaicness of the language that's being used, often the meters that are being used. For example, the Sutta Nipata, a lot of it is written in meter, which is not equivalent to our poetics, for example, in the West, but in certain forms of very ancient meter which are being used, which don't necessarily reappear that commonly in later texts. Later texts will often refer to debates that don't take place in the Buddha's time, refer to historical figures that don't take place. For example, in part of the canon, there is something called the Kadavatu, which is actually in the Abhidhamma, which is a whole set of texts, which are literally translated as points of controversy. It's an argument. And all of these arguments take place post the Buddha's death. So it's clearly not occurring in the Buddha's time. There is also the archaeology that's being done and the epigraphical evidence that's also beginning to emerge on donor statues and statuary in general. So there's quite a lot of different ways we start to date what is so-called early Buddhism. Now, what is interesting, and I'll just say this and pass it over, is what is interesting is some Sanskrit texts, literally written texts, as opposed to, say, the Pali texts which we've received, which are transmitted orally for about 400 years, some Sanskrit texts are actually in written form much older. Yeah. So some of these texts are probably written down around about the 2nd century BCE. And we have fragments of some of those texts which are still extant. So they're clearly very early, but they're sometimes not saying the same sort of things as this body of material which we call the Pali literature, or even some literature which has found its way into the Chinese Agamas, these translations from Sanskrit texts. So there's many, many different approaches to trying to date this material. Unfortunately, I think the people in biblical studies have a much easier task, because this material is huge. It's voluminous. The Pali Canon alone is an enormous body. And so dating it and going through it with, I don't know, a highlighter to try and highlight old bits is extremely difficult. To do that. But one of the big ways, actually a simple answer, is philological grounds.
Could I just add to that? And please. I think John actually gave a very good example with the story of the Sivaka Sutta, this discourse which the Buddha says is asked, is everything the result of our previous karma? And he says, no. It's due to all kinds of things. Now, I think we can learn a great deal from the biblical scholars. Theologians, Greek specialists and so on have now for about 150, nearly 200 years been asking exactly the same questions about the Gospels and the Bible. And they've established a series of criteria to help us understand. Philological, yes, that's very, very important, the actual date, you know, style of language and so on, as John mentioned. But also they have, for example, a thing called the criterion of difference. In other words, if a text conflicts with Buddhist orthodoxy, it's more likely to be early, for the simple reason it wouldn't have been in the interests of orthodoxy to have added it. A text is either early or original, or it's later. Logically, there are only two possibilities. So what would be an indicator of something of an earlier time? One would be that it conflicts with what the later tradition says. Another example, and this is again from biblical scholars, but also Richard Gombrich, for example, has also pointed to this. If the language uses a metaphor and parable rather than a discursive, philosophical, theological type argument, if a teaching uses an image to convey the idea, an image taken from everyday life, this is more likely. And again, biblical scholars use the same thing with Jesus. The concrete imagery is a key to a text being of an earlier rather than a later day. As the religious traditions develop, they tend to become more abstract, more theoretical, more discursive, start using long, complicated words. At the beginning, they tend to use images from everyday life. So that would be another approach.
Another good example is jokes. The jokes tend to be original, as I think, again, as Richard Gombrich points out, that jokes are very rarely made by committees or good ones anyway.
I give you an example. You know, the very earliest parts of the text, we have a feeling, we get the impression from the people who speak in these texts that truth is something that is self-evident. So if we speak of something that is true, this is not a capital T truth, by the way. It's something that is a reality in someone's life. Then the Buddha seems to think that this is something one doesn't have to be a Buddhist for this to be apparent as a truth. Any person endowed with senses, any person of common sense, would be able to recognize the self-evident nature of this fact. 400 or 500 years later, when truth is spoken now in terms of logic, and it is an argument in which logically it cannot be disproven anymore. Yeah. Something is true when it is no longer falsifiable by logical argument. So the whole onus of what truth is has shifted within a couple of hundred years. And if you see the type of argument that goes on in the book, John just mentioned the Kathavattu, then it's obvious that the apparent effort of the community to prove what it deems to be orthodoxy, working along the notion of truth on the basis of logic, you can be sure that this is of later origin. It doesn't mean that it's worthless, but it just means this is a different voice speaking. We have to assume, and this is maybe important to say, the Pali texts are translations. We have to think of those as of translations rather than of absolute originals. The people, there's 350 or so years missing between the death of the Buddha and the writing down of these texts as written texts. Although we don't have physical manuscripts, we know that this has happened roughly in the first century BC somewhere in Sri Lanka. But however you're going to turn it, there's 350 years in which a huge corpus of oral texts has been handed down, has been anthologized, has been collated, has been partly redacted and organized. It's a huge effort of generations of monastics to basically hold these texts, order these texts, transmit these texts, correlate these texts. And that type of work has left traces. So I think the arguments Stephen mentioned, and I think Buddhists can learn a lot from biblical scholars there. They have done that kind of work, and the Buddhists have barely started with this sort of stuff. There are inherent criteria which are tricky. They entail a lot of careful reading and sifting through. They take distancing oneself from one's biases and from one's wishful thinking. And that produces, when weighed, a fairly trustworthy idea of what comes from which stratum of textual development. I hope that's a long answer to a bit of short.
Okay, let's move on to another question. Maybe on this side of the room. I'm sorry, the microphone problem.
Thank you. So I find the discussion about early Buddhism, the ideas and practices that emerge from it, really interesting, helpful. I just have an intuitive sense it's really important. But if I have to justify that to somebody else, I sometimes struggle. And I was wondering if you could kind of help me with that. So one of the examples that I've heard given is, so we don't talk these days about, say, Islamic algebra, even though we know that algebra was developed by Islamic scholars. So to what extent is it important that if there's some really good ideas and practices and values and so on within early Buddhism, how much does it matter what's authentic? If they're good ideas, they're good ideas. If they're not, they're not.
Okay, let me try and summarize that. The questioner is struggles a bit. He feels that there is a lot to be said for what early Buddhism has to offer, but he struggles a bit in trying to communicate it to his friends and others, and wonders whether, in some ways, if an idea is a good idea, it's a good idea. Does it really matter if it's earlier or later? Is that right? So why should we give so much importance to what is earlier, when surely what really matters is whether or not it's a good idea, however late in the story it might have come along? Akinchen, what do you want to do with that?
Well, the truth is we don't really know some of these early good ideas. Because we have traditions that claim to be the legitimate or maybe the sole legitimate mouthpieces of Buddhist teachings, and that actually are not necessarily going back to these very good early ideas, but they go back to maybe the 5th century AD and to a kind of hermeneutical sort of goggle they have put on to explain away all those strange fault lines and disorganized, not quite systematized teachings from the Buddha. And because it was a lot easier, you have to imagine, these situational teachings, a typical sutta is something like, there's a place, if you're lucky, you're told that this is the full moon time of the fourth month, Kartika, Pamudi, like we just had last week, and then so-and-so turns up and goes to the Buddha and asks him something, or the Buddha seems a bit, seems to go and visit some of the competition corner, and have a discussion with them, and then they have an argument, a little dialogue, then he may go home and talk with some of his monks on the way home, and then that's it. Yeah. And the next sutta deals with something completely different, equally situational, equally has a feeling, yeah, this could have happened, but it's totally non-systematic. And you end up with accounts, one after the other, of such account. If you want to know something about this topic, you need to look here, and then there, and then there, and then there, and it's hard work. So Buddhist traditions over the centuries have tried to basically systematize that teachings. And in doing so, they have pruned things out that they felt were not really part of the system, or they seemed to hinder the system's smoothness. They have added things to explain lacuna, which they felt were untoward. They have interpreted things away. Yeah? So you have a passage about the degree of knowledge necessary for the creation of mindfulness and deepening of stillness in the Satipatthana Sutta. And then the commentary says, well, every time it says knowledge, what it really means is 16 types of knowledges, which are this, 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 this. Yeah? So every time you read this with the commentarial goggles, you read 16 knowledges where it only has one. Yeah? And you wonder, well, if the Buddha meant this, he probably would have said it, wouldn't he? You know, he was quite capable of saying difficult and complicated things. But after a while, you get used to reading this passage through a particular interpretative framework, and that's one of the reasons why traditions sometimes obstruct that very getting in touch with those early ideas. Does that make sense? I know this is not the sales pitch for convincing your friends of early Buddhism. It may help understand you some of this.
Do you want to comment on that, John? Yes, I think I think, you know, just following on from what Akinchino, not repeating what he said, but I think following on from what Akinchino says, the traditions give us a particular picture. As Wittgenstein once said, once you're presented with a picture, it holds you captive. And you don't see anything particularly outside of that picture. I think what we're doing in the study of early Buddhism is recapturing the bits that are not included in the picture. And actually some really fundamentally interesting bits that are not included in the picture. Particularly around things like meditation, karma, as you've heard me say earlier on. There's a huge range of things I think we can gather, and we can even get a different perspective on, just by returning to that early material. Redactors, as I said, actually present us with a reading which is a reading which presents something coherent. Because of that situation that Akinchino said, actually, the Buddha's teaching isn't necessarily coherent in the sense of always being the same in every particular instance that he gives that teaching. His teaching develops. Sometimes those early good ideas get lost and the later ones get reinforced and picked up and taken up. And I think it's recovering, I think, the nuancing behind some of these ideas and the different ways that the Buddha presents them, because I think there's, as you rightly said, I think there's something important about this for this era. Not just about simply going back and interestingly doing the archaeology on this material in a sort of intellectual way and recovering it, but I think we're doing it from the point of view of there is something interesting for this particular era, actually, that the traditions don't speak about, because the traditions present us with that particular picture.
Yeah, I mean, I would concur with all of that, particularly that last point that John made. But also, I think I would like to also offer a personal confession here, is that after many years of training in particularly Tibetan Buddhism and then in Zen Buddhism, my quest for what, in a sense, lies at the heart of the Dharma, which I do feel as a Buddhist a great faith in, to be honest, I found that the many of these earliest notions seem to speak to my existential condition more directly, more vividly, with its images, with its practices, with its simplicity, with its lack of dogma and complex metaphysics. So, you know, this is a personal commitment that I have come up with. At the same time, I think we have to be careful not to succumb to what's called the genetic fallacy. In other words, if it's earlier, it's more true or better. That may not be the case. And I think, you know, part of our understanding of early Buddhism is to enable us to see more clearly which teachings and philosophies and practices that evolved at later dates seem to further illuminate and clarify these earlier ideas, and which tend to either obscure them or tend to give them a bias from, say, Indian culture that disables somehow their ability to speak to our condition today. Next question. Alex, you choose. Okay, we'll stick on this one.
Thanks. Stephen, I think you said that these early teachings could have some relevance for our economy and our political life. And I was wondering if you could be specific.
So this is addressed. So the question has to do that I mentioned that these teachings may have to do with our economic and political life, and if I could perhaps be more specific. Okay, I'll give you an example. The third sermon the Buddha is supposed to have delivered is called the Discourse on Fire, where he says the world is burning. And it's burning with what? It's burning with greed, it's burning with hatred, it's burning with delusion. Now, if we fast forward
to today, we find ourselves in a situation where the world is heating up, quite literally. And it is heating up to a large extent because of our greed, of our hatred, and our confusion. So there seems, although I don't believe the Buddha was looking into the future and getting a sort of an early warning on global heating, early warning on global warming, but nonetheless, what he seems to have used in that imagery allows us perhaps to consider how that our economic life, our political life, is very often driven by unbridled attachments and greeds and fears. In terms of our political conflicts between hatred and different between different communities and different groups, all of which probably have their roots somehow in our conception of who we think we are and what we feel that we need. And our current climate crisis is throwing enormous questions at our society as to how should therefore we live if we all agree that we're polluting the oceans and we're heating up the atmosphere. That's all very well, but where? But how can we find a way of life that would enable us to live with less greed, less hatred, less confusion? Now, I think that's simply, in a sense, a sort of a template that still requires to be very much fleshed out in detail as to how a Buddhist vision of how a human person might live more fully, might flourish, is premised on the idea that genuine human flourishing, it results from the letting go of greed, the letting go of hatred, the letting go of confusion. Therefore, these teachings are not just about making me happier. They're very much about envisioning a human society that is premised on very different values and principles than those that consumer capitalism is built upon. Now, that's a very sort of ambitious thing to say, perhaps, but I do feel we have to start with that broad recognition of the condition we are in, and I would hope, in its beginning, there are Buddhist teachers now who are writing and trying to figure out social theory, economic theory. It's early days. But I feel that this is a very important contribution that the Buddhist tradition can make to addressing these primary crises that we face as a global community today. Do you want to add to that? Yeah. Okay, maybe over here now.
Yeah, sure.
Can I ask two questions to follow the tradition that seems to start with? In your views, what does engagement with early Buddhism tell us about the value for us in contemporary life or traditional practices of recollecting the Buddha, and perhaps of devotional practices in general? And secondly, again, what does engagement with early Buddhism tell us about the value for us now of monasticism?
Okay, let me just repeat those two questions. The first one has to do with how our engagement with early Buddhism affects traditional practices like recollection of the Buddha and devotional practices on the one hand, and secondly, what does our engagement with early Buddhism have to tell us about the value of monasticism today in our world? As a former monastic, I think a Kitchener is all that.
There's all former
monastics. We're all former monastics.
Well, I'm happy to answer. So, anusati practices, recollections, are squarely part of earliest Buddhist teaching. There is no question in my mind that they have a firm place in any form of serious meditative undertaking. The role of monasticism, monastics are to be applauded. I believe the more the merrier. You know, it's not really such a popular pastime to become a monastic. Well, the ones that do exist are generally held in high esteem. It's not so that the people in hordes are flocking into the monasteries. I just think that we shouldn't leave transmission of early Buddhist teachings to the monastic tradition. The monastic tradition has its own agendas and has its own challenges. I am not yet convinced that it has completely landed in the West. I support the existence of monasteries. I'm grateful personally for my 20 years in monastic life. At the same time, I'm also clear that some of the dialogue I feel is needed with secular society is held rather tenuously from within the monastic communities. I also have great unease at how the monastic communities I'm familiar with handle women and femininity in general, and I wouldn't want to leave that entirely in the hands of traditionalist monastics. I'm sure my two co-teachers have a few things to say on this.
Well, John? Mm.
I think one of the first things to say, I think it's clear from the Western world and what we've seen in the development of Buddhism in the Western world, that although monasticism plays a part, it's not going to be the dominant feature of Western society. And this is very unusual, and that's what's really striking about looking at the early movement and what has actually happened in the Western movement, because every culture, in fact, that Buddhism has moved into, the primary base for the development of, you know, the ideas and the meditational practices and everything else has been the establishment of monasteries in those cultures, primarily. And so if you look at most of these cultures, it was the establishment of monastic communities which aided this transmission to lay communities. When we look at it within the West, the Western world, yes, I think there is a need for monastics, there is a need for these communities, but they're not going to be the dominant part of our society. And I think, you know, you've only got to look at this group here and say, you know, there's no monastics here. You know, even if you call yourself a Buddhist, you're not a monastic. You're actually living and working within Western culture. And so the transmission of Buddhism is taking place in a very, very different way to the way it's taking place traditionally. And I think that's always worth remembering. So the form of Buddhism we're going to get is not based on that renunciate tradition. And I think it almost feeds into, though, the question that Stephen was asked, you know, although it might sound very different, in the sense of, okay, well, traditionally, greed, aversion and delusion was meant to be dealt with by these specialists. They were called monks and nuns. You know? And if people in the lay community dealt with it in any degree, that was considered to be all to the better. But the specialists in this were the monastics. That's clearly not the case in the West. And I think it's really important that we establish the practices in our lay secular societies with the sort of social structures that we have and the way people live in these societies. The monastics are going to feed into it. I don't think they're going to be the dominant part of that transmission. That's my feeling.
Okay. We have time for one more question, and then we'd like to... A woman, please. Shad, did you have a question? Or here? Okay.
This is really a question for Stephen, because I've been reading you for university, but you all know about this question anyway, so I'd like to hear for his answer. It's what happens to nirvana in secular Buddhism. That's what my question boils down to.
Okay, the question has to do with what happens to nirvana in secular Buddhism. Good question. I'll say a few words and then I'll pass this on to my colleagues. Well, first of all, what do we mean by nirvana? I work with the definition that we find in the suttas, where nirvana is the ending of greed, the ending of hatred, the ending of confusion. And this is not something that, as John is suggesting, is attainable only by professional monastics, monks and nuns who meditate and practice for donkey's years. There's a passage also in the suttas where the Buddha says nirvana is clearly visible and immediate. That the stopping of greed, hatred and delusion is not some permanent state, but it is a possibility that is open to us in each moment. This is how I would take it. I would take nirvana to be an affirmation of the possibility of leading a life that is premised on a non-reactive awareness that is not conditioned or programmed by our basest impulses and imperatives, but has found a freedom within us here and now to respond to the challenges and the suffering of ourselves and others in a non-reactive way. And so for me, I would bring nirvana very much into the heart of life itself as a possibility that is imminent in each person, in each moment, somewhat along the lines that we find, say, in Zen and some of the other later traditions. But again, this is a question that's going to be explored, hopefully clarified as we proceed, but certainly something I think that all of us regard as a very crucial part of what it means to live and breathe as a Dharma practitioner in this world.
Yeah. I think this is absolutely vital. This is the heart of the practice, nirvana. This is what people are practicing for. And actually, one of the things of the reading of early Buddhism, it doesn't give us a sense of it being easy, but it gives us a sense of being something doable by people. And rather than an image which is all too often propagated as being some kind of Buddhist heaven to which people aspire, and you might reach it or you don't, the image that's there in the early text is one of a skill rather than a place. And that skill is, I'll go back to the literal translation of this term, nirvana, when it has two different ways of defining it. One is an intransitive verb, which means gone out, and that refers to what Stephen was talking about, the going out, or literally the extinguishing of greed, aversion, and delusion. But it also refers to unbinding. So the basic premise is that the human condition is one that's bound to a psychology that emanates from greed, aversion, and delusion. And so nirvana, or more correctly, if it's a verb form, nirvana-ing, or nirvana-ing, if you're using the Sanskrit form, becomes a skill which one can attain. But it's not a skill which you kind of save up your merit and finally get it in one big accumulation at the end, when you cash it in. But it's something which is occurring moment by moment, in the sense of being able to bind from psychologically restricting conditions which particularly are aligned to habit patterns. And so one learns to unbind it. So there's many different senses of nirvana. From very, very intense low-grade nirvana, when we free ourselves of a habit and get a sense of freedom from freeing ourselves from a very basic habit. Because we're humans, we often fall back into those habits, but we can unbind again. So unbinding becomes, if you like, a skill which we can develop over the course of our lives. And it's actually essential. I think you can show what to say something.
I just want to reassure you that none of us believe that nirvana is to be secularized away and to become basically a pleasant little mind state. There is in the image of nirvana the metaphor of fire implied. In the Indian tradition, the metaphor of fire is such that God's Agni is manifest in actuality as a flame, and when it is gone out, as in Nibbateti, so it is gone into an ineffable latency. So it has become unspeakable. It's something that you cannot describe anymore in terms or in attributes. So it refers to a dimension that is essentially non-describable anymore within the terms and conventions of, say, a semantic world. And the Buddha uses this image and he uses this term as a kind of the last sayable metaphor for a state of freedom. And I think that is to be upheld. I would really not wish a Buddhism that does not uphold this vision for human growth.
I think this is I'm sorry, we're running out of time. We're going to have to move into the next concluding phase of our evening together. We have about 10 minutes left. And I know this sounds terribly shameless, but we're going to talk about the Bodhi Institute. We'd like to just briefly each say what our vision is for this institute. We've talked about early Buddhism. Bodhi Institute is an institution that is trying to focus attention on these questions we've been discussing this evening, and present courses and programs, retreats that will hopefully deepen and further develop such an understanding that we've been describing. So I'm going to ask John and then Akinchino just to say a few words about their particular vision of the Bodhi Institute, and perhaps they could also say something about their own courses that they will be involved in, and so you can have a clearer idea of what we're actually going to do. John.
Okay, well, I think you've probably gathered from this evening that all of us are fairly passionate about this material. I think my particular vision about the Bodhi Institute really comes into putting that passion into something which is serviceable to the contemporary era, something that changes and makes a difference in people's lives, not by dogmatism, but by actually helping people to find a way of questioning and understanding which leads to that sense, I think we've all mentioned this term, to a sense of human flourishing, what it means to flourish, but not necessarily in the ways that are often given to us by our society. That was alluded to in one of the questions, wasn't it? How society often results in, I don't know, corporate greed, aversion and delusion, written globally. And we have a big problem with that. And I think what is so fundamental about this urban material is it gives us a different vision of what it might mean to live in a flourishing way, but without all of the paraphernalia and all of the acquisition that often goes with contemporary life. I think it's there in the so-called meditative practices. One of the things I was going to add to the question on meditation was, and I think this is really, really important, because the word meditation, or what's translated as meditation, this word that Stephen mentioned, bhavana, means cultivation. Never let it forget that we're always cultivating something in our lives. What do you want to cultivate? Do you want to cultivate greed and aversion and delusion? Because that's so easy to do in our lives.
So encouraged.
And so encouraged, that's right. From the advertising hoardings to, you know, just the
parental advice.
The wants that we have. And I think what is so interesting about this early material and what I want to see coming out of the Bodhi Institute's teaching is a way of helping us to flourish in ways which develop the opposites of that. Instead of greed, we get some forms of generosity and sense of community. Instead of aversion, we get some sense of kindness in our societies and in the individual, because it only starts with the individual. I mean, the Buddha's understanding is very much one of working from individual psychology is actually to work into a social psychology and then into a global psychology. And I think it's that sense that I really want to bring to the fore. Some of that will require, in my own case, of going back to early texts and really digging out, as I was saying, some of the nuggets which are there. Also, with bringing a greater understanding of this big area of development which has occurred. You know, it's almost, well, I'd hate the term, it's gone viral in a sense, hasn't it? Mindfulness in the Western world. You know, when you get all-party parliamentary groups giving you recommendations on mindfulness, and yet we still don't really understand a lot about mindfulness in many, many ways, and certainly not from the nuancing of the tradition. I would like to see that operating in a closer dialogue with these secular forms of mindfulness, and with the understanding of these ancient texts and the way that they can inform and actually balance and nuance the ways that we approach it, and bring in a perspective which actually is getting dropped in a lot of contemporary dialogue, but particularly in the contemporary dialogue often that's going around mindfulness, which is the ethical basis of this, because the Buddha never actually developed and taught anything unless it had some kind of cash-out value in terms of the way we live ethically. And that was the important part. If anything, he was an ethical reformist. Again, I'm interested in looking at that and bringing that out in terms of the work certainly I'm doing in the Bodhi Institute, and I'm sure others are doing as well. This, to me, is part of the bigger vision of what we're about.
Let me say a few more mundane words. I think Bodhi Institute so far is
an educational charity. It's a vision that we wish to institutionalize. Some of what we're already doing in differing formats, teaching people who are generally interested in meditation that there are other aspects of Buddhist teaching which are often not conveyed in a meditative retreat format that would be worth knowing. And in fact, that would help translating some of meditative experience into the lived life as we experience it. So,
for example?
For example, she said. Yes, which part would you like an example for? The institution, or the teaching, or the aspect of the teaching?
The aspects of the teaching.
So, you know, people have valid meditative experience, and then they go back home and think about their meditative experience in obsolete models of thinking about themselves. In other words, they translate some of the valid stuff they've actually experienced into models that are no longer accurate, thereby reinforcing some notions of self and other and world that may be highly counterproductive to their meditative attempts. Yeah?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I want to understand more.
So this is, there is obviously an interface between Buddhist teaching and psychology, between Buddhist teaching and epistemology, between Buddhist teaching and philosophy, between Buddhist teaching and ethics, between Buddhist teaching and education. And some of this could take place in Bodhi Institute. It is unlikely to take place in a silent meditation retreat where you're not supposed to talk.
Yeah.
Silent meditation retreats are precious. We all teach them. We have the support of organizations that teach these. We are regularly appearing in such organizations, but at the same time we're conscious there's only so much that this format yields in terms of being able to convey other aspects of Buddhist teaching that have a great bearing on life, but not necessarily only on meditative practice. And we feel that we need to organize our efforts as we're getting older to actually get something off the ground that may survive us as a possible umbrella for teaching of early Buddhist material across Europe in different venues, in different combinations of teacher with both guests and core teachers of that institute. My part of it is I'm interested in the interface with psychology, psychologies, not just psychotherapies, but psychologies, because there are models of thinking about human beings that I believe Buddhist teaching has a lot to offer, a lot of promises and a vision of great compassion and humanity that I see in Buddhist teaching that sometimes I lack, I don't see to that extent in our mental health organizations, for example. So there's a lot to be done on that front. We also have a study program for people, committed meditators who wish to have more exposure to scriptural teaching and the translation of these scriptural teachings into their lives. Remember that second type of translation I initially spoke. This is something we do. We're all part of this. And we have modular events where we address particular topics, say the interface with psychotherapy, or John is passionate about the Atta Kavada and the Sutta Nipata. Stephen has his secular Dharma program. Christina, John, and I are sharing some passion that we need to speak with the mindfulness world. We are of the impression that some of the mindfulness world would do well to learn a little more about the context of mindfulness, because the mindfulness world is struggling with actually coming to terms with defining this, and it's always good if you're really keen on something and you want to teach it to everybody, that you have actually a clearer idea of what it is. And not just what it is so that you can define it easily in three sentences, but actually what it is so that it makes human beings more free and more happy and more whole and lowers their cortisol levels and their blood pressure and so forth and the whole rest of it. So there is some work to be done. We hope to interface with the mindfulness world on that front. And we hope also to do some language courses. At some point we have We have yet to do some more thinking about the long-term vision, but basically, it looks like there's plenty of work carved out.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Let me just conclude by pointing to you. We have a website, www.bodhi-institute.org. We have some flyers, I think, on the table out the front if you want to see what actual courses we have. Be aware that the two-year courses, the Committed Practitioners Program and the Secular Dharma Program, are filling up. If you're interested in these longer programs, which you'll be working together with a small community, you'll be interacting over this time, offering opportunities to really go into more depth into many of these core ideas. We have our program for mindfulness teachers to deepen their understanding of the context of mindfulness. And we have a number of standalone modules on particular Buddhist texts or particular Buddhist concepts. But we're also a charity. We have to fund all of this. We have two employees now who are involved in our administration and in our booking procedures. And this kind of employment is likely to grow as our courses unfold. We have long-term strategic planning to get involved in. And for all of this, we require funding. And so we've decided for this evening that anything that you would wish to offer in terms of Dharma to the three of us, there's a box out there, but this will go not to us personally, it will go to the Bodhi Institute as a donation. And if you have the means and if you have the interest in supporting our work as an institution, we'd be very grateful for any funding or donations that you could give, either as a one-off donation or as a regular contribution to our work. Again, details for how to make such offers are clearly stated on our website. You can find all that information out. The three of us will be here for a little bit longer, not much. We both all have to go. If you'd like to talk to us about any of these things, please do so. And if you can't have the chance to speak to us in person now, you can email us through the Bodhi Institute website and we'll be in touch with you. So we'd be very grateful for whatever support you are able to offer us, this fledgling organization that's trying its best now to really get off the ground, and we'll be beginning our courses next year, in the beginning of next year. And this, of course, is in effect the launch. This is the first public outing of Bodhi Institute. Regrettably, Christina Feldman, who's another member of our core faculty, couldn't be here this evening. But the four of us, thank you very much indeed for having spent this evening listening to us, and we hope this has been fruitful for you.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Thank you.